Welcome to the Viscast. I'm your host, Josh Viss. This is the second episode of the Viscast, and I am happy to be finally releasing another episode. This episode concentrates on Jerusalem for, I suppose, obvious reasons. President Trump's decision to recognize Jerusalem as the capital of Israel put the Israeli-Palestinian conflict back in the news for about a week. Now, if you're a casual observer of this conflict, you probably wondered what all the fuss was about. Well, this episode will help you understand the fuss. My guest for this discussion is Yahav Zohar, who is an Israeli tour guide. He gives alternative tours, which are political and cultural and focus on the history and current realities of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. He does tours of East Jerusalem for our groups, and they are excellent. He is the perfect person to talk to about Jerusalem and its role in the conflict. We discuss his thoughts on Trump's announcement, which may surprise you. Yahav briefly explains the recent history of Jerusalem. He explains the difficult and unequal treatment Palestinians of East Jerusalem endure. He talks about the separation barrier and how it affects East Jerusalem and also how it helps Israeli security. This bit on the wall and Israeli security is, I think, surprising and fascinating. The way in which it helps is not the way we often think. At the end, we speculate a little bit about Trump's reasons for acknowledging Jerusalem as the capital of Israel. So this episode is packed full of good, important stuff. As always, thank you for listening. And if you like what you hear, please recommend this podcast to others. Okay, Yahav, thanks for carving out some time to talk to us about the politics of Jerusalem, essentially. So I guess I'll ask you first, what is your general reaction to President Trump announcing that the United States recognizes Jerusalem as the capital of Israel?
I have to say I don't really understand. I'm sure, or I guess there's a reason why he chose to say this and what base it appeals to and whatever it means in the internal politics of the United States. The fact is, Jerusalem is, in fact, Israel's functioning capital. That's where the parliament sits, the Supreme Court, most of the government ministries. And no country in the world recognizes this because they consider Israel's control of East Jerusalem illegal by international law, and that since Israel insists that Jerusalem is West and East Jerusalem both, all the countries of the world refuse to recognize Jerusalem as Israel's capital. Although de facto politicians come, they meet Israeli politicians at the Israeli ministries, at the Knesset in Jerusalem. Trump, like all previous American presidents for a long time, stayed in Jerusalem, met with the prime minister in Jerusalem, and so do many leaders of countries that don't officially recognize. So that's a diplomatic nuance or maybe game, as far as I understand, to say we don't recognize, but in fact, coming there, meeting, working with the Israeli government.
Yeah.
Trump's decision to make this announcement obviously upsets many people who feel that the continued insistence on not recognizing is somehow is supporting or asserting the right of the Palestinians to a capital in East Jerusalem. But I have to say, none of those people who are crying out against this, none of those governments have ever done anything to actually practically support Palestinians getting a capital in East Jerusalem, and they've done a lot to in fact recognize Jerusalem as Israel's working capital.
Yeah, that's helpful. What is it about East Jerusalem that in theory these countries who do not and continue to not recognize Jerusalem as the capital of Israel, what is it about East Jerusalem that they object to?
Well, about Israel's government of East Jerusalem that they object to. So I guess maybe a little bit of background, right? Jerusalem was split in the 1948 war. The 1949 armistice made the line between what we call today West and East Jerusalem. And in that war, there was, on both sides, the forced movement of population. So the Jordanian army forced Jews out of East Jerusalem that it conquered, and the Israeli army forced Palestinians, a much greater number of Palestinians, out of West Jerusalem that it conquered. And so the armistice line, that's called also the Green Line, separates today Jews in West Jerusalem and Palestinians in East Jerusalem. And that border that also the U.S. and also all the other countries in the world, that line that used to run through Jerusalem, all those countries still insist that that's the only legal border. That border was practically wiped away in the 1967 war, when the Israeli army came through and conquered East Jerusalem and the larger surrounding area known as the West Bank. So now Israel, for the last 50 years, Israel has ruled both West and East Jerusalem. In West Jerusalem, there's basically just Jews, or almost just Jews. And in East Jerusalem, there's a very large Palestinian population that's under Israeli rule, a part of the Jerusalem municipality. But most of the people inside, the Palestinians inside, have not received Israeli citizenship. They're 30-something percent, almost 40% of the residents of Israel's de facto capital, Jerusalem, but they're not Israeli citizens. They don't have the vote for the Israeli parliament that sits in Jerusalem. All the countries of the world, including, still, as far as I understand, the U.S., consider that Israeli rule of East Jerusalem as illegal, and they consider East Jerusalem, like the other territories conquered in the 1967 war, to be occupied territories that should become a future Palestinian state, that Israel should leave to allow Palestinians independence. And in all the formulations, all the things that have been said by the United Nations, by the European Union, also by the U.S. State Department, they say the capital of that future independent state of Palestine should be in East Jerusalem. So the program, as far as international decisions, as far as the international community is concerned, should be to have two capitals in Jerusalem, Israel in West Jerusalem and the future state of Palestine in East Jerusalem. And the Israeli government insists that this cannot happen and that the United Jerusalem, that is both East and West Jerusalem, are Israel's eternal capital. Indivisible forever. And that's basically the words of Israeli law. And so in protest of this, all the countries moved their embassies out of Jerusalem. That was a 1981 Jerusalem law, and said, we refuse to recognize Jerusalem as capital and have our embassies in Jerusalem until you leave East Jerusalem and make it Palestinian capital, basically.
So can I ask you, when President Trump recognizes Jerusalem as the capital of Israel, is he necessarily, or maybe it's more about what each side hears, do Israelis hear him accepting the United or Greater Jerusalem as a part of Israel? Where and in this case, I would guess, based on Palestinians' reaction, they're hearing the same thing?
Right. So, again, this is the part that I don't understand so well. All the responses to this. It seems to me very manufactured. That is, the fact is that East Jerusalem is under Israeli rule and Palestinians in Jerusalem are discriminated against in services and in access, and are often under quite brutal police rule in many cases. And that East Jerusalem is surrounded by a huge concrete wall, which separates it from Ramallah, from Bethlehem, from what used to be its suburbs, choking it economically, socially, politically. There is a real crisis on the ground. But the fact that someone made a statement, and I think you're right, that statement is a very, he didn't say we recognize East Jerusalem. He did say that, I believe, that he supports a two-state solution. So he did not say what's happening in Jerusalem now is fine. He just said we recognize it as capital. Why that is so important to so many people, I have to say, I'm pretty puzzled. It seems to me a symptom of being disconnected from the daily realities and obsessed with statements that don't seem to me to mean so much.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't disagree with you there. I think for some reason, people are hearing this as a definitive statement that maybe once and for all puts to rest the idea that a two-state solution is actually possible. Some people were still holding on to it, but in saying this and reversing years of U.S. policy, Trump is really putting an end to the charade of the United States as some sort of honest broker between Israelis and Palestinians. What do you think about that?
Well, I think that that charade was never bought anywhere outside the United States, maybe. The U.S. sends Israel $4 billion of weapons, vetoes any decision against it in the U.N. Security Council, is a very, very strong, and keeps saying this, an absolute ally of Israel. Mm-hmm. They don't say the same things or act the same way about Palestinians. So it's very, very clear that the U.S. sees itself on the side of Israel. Its role as mediator, as honest mediator, I don't think Palestinians or people in the Middle East ever really believed. And I don't think this statement is the thing that's going to really change that.
Yeah.
And again, it's much more than statements is the weapons shipments, the Security Council vetoes, and the constant wherever we stand with Israel.
Can you imagine, honestly, East Jerusalem ever becoming the capital of a Palestinian state?
Look, I think any significant change to our situation is hard for most people in this country to imagine, because we've been so long in this situation of the absolute Israeli rule of Palestinians and Palestinians being sort of helpless to counter that. But things do change, right? If history teaches us anything. Mm-hmm. Things do change, and they don't change the way they were expected to change. They don't change. I always tell people who are asking about questions like this on tours about the future, nobody ever predicted any significant. No agency or academy predicted the Arab Spring, the fall of the Berlin Wall, the end of apartheid, the war in Yugoslavia. Historical events they're so complicated and they're so unpredictable. I can tell you, I wouldn't really like to see, like in my mind, this idea that the international community has that really Jerusalem somehow needs to be split and a border run through it again would be very unattractive to me as somebody who lives in Jerusalem and spends a lot of time in both East and West Jerusalem and enjoys both. And they're both my city. And what I would like to see is in whatever solution is Jerusalem remain as an open city. So some solution where if there were a Palestinian parliament in East Jerusalem, so there'd be two separate municipalities, but they'd have to be in very close cooperation and they'd have to have absolutely open borders. It really is one city functionally. And I think the whole thing of the two-state solution is not necessarily dead, but is very unattractive to have two states absolutely separated, because really our lives, Israelis and Palestinians, are so intertwined, also in many good ways. And so I'd like to see maybe something like a federation or one state with some cultural autonomy for both. So we'd live with open borders. Jerusalem would be a shared and open city.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm going to come back to that sort of possibilities for the future, because I want to give you an opportunity to talk a little bit about the current disparity in life in East Jerusalem versus in Palestinian side of Jerusalem versus life in West Jerusalem, the mm-hmm. Israeli side.
Yeah.
What are the most salient differences that you would highlight?
Well, there's economics. East Jerusalem is much poorer, but that's happening because of the way, or a lot of it is happening because of the way it's being governed. So the Jerusalem municipality, the Israeli Jerusalem municipality, has a policy which is very, very restrictive of any building and development in Palestinian neighborhoods. So there's a huge housing shortage and overcrowding in the schools, and also a less official policy, but of just neglect of the Palestinian neighborhoods, where the roads are very poor, the water service is very poor, all the things that are the responsibility of the municipality and the Israeli government, or the public services, are very poor compared to West Jerusalem and to the Israeli neighborhoods that have been built into East Jerusalem, what are often called settlements. And you can drive in East Jerusalem itself, where in between the Palestinian neighborhoods is newly built Israeli neighborhoods, and suddenly you get a fine wide road and gardening and lawns, and then you keep driving another few hundred yards and you come back into a Palestinian neighborhood and there's potholes and there's no sidewalk and there's no effective garbage collection. And it's the same municipality, but treating its residents very, very unequally.
And just to reiterate, everybody is paying the same taxes and therefore should, in theory, be receiving something at least close to equal services for those taxes.
Right. You might say that, yeah. We're all residents of the city. We're all paying property taxes, but services are distributed very unevenly. Now, that happens many places, right?
Mm-hmm.
In the U.S., there's neighborhoods which get better service and less. And that has something to do with wealth, and but a lot to do also with the political influence or organization of people in those neighborhoods. And in East Jerusalem, people don't have the vote. They're not citizens, and just the system tends to pass them over is one thing. Another thing is there's actually official statements and policy by the Israeli government. We want to keep a strong Jewish majority in Jerusalem. We want to encourage Jews to live in Jerusalem. And unstated, we want to discourage Palestinians from living here to keep a strong Jewish majority in the city. So the neglect in the Palestinian neighborhoods is also can be understood as a tool to push people out.
So the Palestinians who live in Jerusalem, the vast majority of them are considered residents. They have residency status. They're not citizens, as you mentioned.
Right.
When did that begin? When did they start giving the status of resident, and how do you keep that status, I guess, if you're a Palestinian living in East Jerusalem? And lastly, this might be a little harder, what if you're a Palestinian in the West Bank and you'd like to be a resident of Jerusalem. Is that possible?
Right. Okay.
That's a lot of things I realize.
Right. So the residency status was, you know, exists in the law of every country for immigrants. But in Jerusalem, there was a many very strange legal decisions by the Israeli government in Jerusalem. And one of them is this, that those Palestinians who came under Israeli rule in Jerusalem in 1967 do not receive Israeli citizenship, rather residency. And residency is different from citizenship in many ways. One, I already said, is a vote. But another very important one is residency is something you can lose. Citizenship is something basically guaranteed you for life, and residency is something you can lose. And the easiest way to lose your residency is to change your place of residence. So, as I said, there is huge housing shortage and physical neglect in the Palestinian neighborhoods of East Jerusalem. And people who move even to nearby suburbs, which are outside the municipal boundary of the city, lose, after a few years, their residency status. With it, their access to Israeli education, welfare, and, very importantly, physical access to the city of Jerusalem and to 80% of the country, to everything but the West Bank. So people don't want to lose their residency. They crowd in the existing houses. They build unpermitted extensions on the houses for their growing families and pay very heavy fines and live in very poorly planned and overcrowded neighborhoods. And many people do lose their residency. The Israeli government brings cases, brings documents to show people have left and strips them of their residency status. And then people can appeal that in court and pay a lot of money and spend many years trying to get their residency back, as many people are doing and have done, and get a great hassle and a huge expense in the Israeli court system, and often lose. For people from the West Bank to get a residency, to move into East Jerusalem, is virtually impossible at this point. The most common way to do that is, in fact, to marry. So people from the West Bank marry people from East Jerusalem, and then they can move in with them, and eventually, after a long process, receive residency status. And in between, often be in a strange in-between status where they can't work, don't have health insurance while they're in Jerusalem, waiting for their status to come through. And that also has been made increasingly difficult by the Israeli courts and the Israeli Ministry of Interior, to the point where now it's very difficult and a very long and complex process to get residency for people coming from the West Bank, even those who are married to people from East Jerusalem.
So would you say, is it fair to say that Israel is trying to discourage both more Palestinians from becoming residents of Jerusalem and also trying to get those who are residents of Jerusalem out somehow?
Well,
or no?
Yes, I guess that's true. But I would say the much more or a very dramatic effect of all this is not just to move people out, but much more in daily life to just weaken the community, the Palestinian public of East Jerusalem, because they're under all these grinding pressures of overcrowding, of the threat of loss of residency, of the threat of home demolition, the huge fines to pay. And that means that everybody's just too busy and too stressed and too oppressed, one might say, often to effectively organize and demand their rights and stand up for their political rights. And the feeling, my feeling is that that is in fact the main thrust of all this policy, that the Israeli government is really worried about these 300,000 Palestinians or so in East Jerusalem are on the Israeli side of the separation wall with access to Tel Aviv, with good Hebrew, with a potential to be a significant social political force to try to press for change in Israel and for Palestinians. And so keeping them under all this pressure is helping to control them. I think that's a very major effect. And yeah, it's also a very slow war of attrition where people are gradually forced out. It's not really working in the sense that more babies are being born than people are leaving. Mm-hmm. But it is making the community poorer, weaker, and less functional as a community.
How prevalent is the issue of home demolitions? You mentioned it, and I'm guessing some people listening wouldn't know what you mean when you say home demolitions. Can you explain that and then tell me how prevalent it is, or why is it an issue at all?
All right. So, as I said, the Israeli government, the Jerusalem municipality, is very, very restrictive for any building and development in Palestinian neighborhoods. And people have growing families, and the population grows, and people need more housing. And if they move out to the suburbs, they lose their residency and their access to the city and their health insurance. So they stay more and more crowded in, and eventually, in many cases, they also add on to their houses extra rooms, extra floors, without permit. And sometimes also build whole new buildings without permit. And usually what happens is they get a very, very heavy fine to pay, which they can never really afford. It's hundreds of thousands, and then they end up paying it in installments for years. And usually, as long as you keep paying up the installments, they won't come and demolish your house. But then sometimes they will. So there's many, many thousands of unpermitted structures in East Jerusalem, tens of thousands perhaps. And somewhere 70 or 80 get demolished every year. So you might say in the big picture, it's not so much, but it is 70 or 80 families being made homeless, or more, because many of these buildings have more than one family living in them. And what happens is, it's like a giant lottery, basically. So in many cases, even when the bulldozers roll in, people don't know which house they're coming for. And they go in with a huge force of men with machine guns and armored jeeps, and they surround the house and get the family out and demolish it while all the neighborhood's watching. Dozens of houses a year, and they spread it out through the neighborhoods, so everybody has this experience alive in their minds. And the sense in many cases, where many people's houses are unpermitted or parts of them are, that this could happen to them at any moment. And it's one of the many threats that's always hanging there, and it occasionally gets carried out, and when it does, it's terrible for the people that it happens to, but it also has a powerful psychological effect on the whole neighborhood, eventually the whole city.
Right. Tell me about the role that the separation barrier plays, or the security wall, or whatever you call it. What role does that play in the life in the community of East Jerusalem?
Well, the wall was built not between Jewish West Jerusalem and Palestinian East Jerusalem, because as far as Israel is concerned, they're all united Jerusalem. The wall was built between East Jerusalem and its Palestinian suburbs, so between the two different Palestinian communities. And that has very dramatic effects also on all those people in the suburbs who overwhelmingly are no longer allowed in to the city through the wall. And then on the city, because a city is that place that people come into to go to market, to go to a hospital, to go to a mosque, to go to theater, whatever. Since the vast majority of the people who used to come to East Jerusalem and use it as their market city, as their functional center, no longer have access to it. With that also disappeared a vast section of the economy of East Jerusalem, the employment, and also the social cultural function, because it's no longer a center, it's no longer a hub, it's no longer vibrant, it's no longer, it's been cut off from its environment. And that has a very dramatic effect, isolating the people of East Jerusalem, creating a very dramatic economic crisis there, and separating East Jerusalem effectively from the rest of the Palestinians of the West Bank.
So to this point, you have not yet said anything about the wall functioning for security. Why is that?
Well, you asked of the effects on the city, but the wall, the thing about the wall is people do get around and across it, unlike without permits. Unlike, let's say, the Israeli fence around Gaza, which is manned with automatic shooters and drones and has a shoot-to-kill zone around it. And the separation wall is a big concrete wall with an electric signifier wire, but people do find ways to climb over it, to crawl under it. And that's usually young men coming to work, probably several thousand of them or more every week coming in to work in Israel without permit. They're taking a great risk. They're going to be arrested. They're going to be... But the wall is not stopping what this shows us. The wall is not stopping determined individuals willing to take risks. It's stopping the normal commuter. So it's not, as it's sometimes pictured, the physical thing stopping the attackers coming at us. What it does do, though, is put a chokehold on hundreds of thousands of people who now need, if they're, they could climb and crawl over if they're young and fit, and but they'd be constantly afraid on the other side to be stopped and arrested for being without papers and not ever getting a permit again. So people want permits, which means more power for the Israeli secret police to draft informants and collaborators. So you want a permit to get into Jerusalem, work with us, report on anybody who's organizing or planning anything. In that sense, you might say the wall is part of Israel's security system, which includes also a huge array of electronic surveillance and prisons and special prisons and night raids that go into the neighborhoods of East Jerusalem, regularly knocking down doors at 3 a.m. and arresting 13-year-olds for throwing stones and such. So there is a huge system of oppression in place, which the wall and the permits to get through have become a part of. In that sense, the wall is part of Israel's security system, but not in the simplistic sense that, I mean, people physically can get around it if they're determined enough.
Yeah, that's helpful. I don't think even I, even though I've heard you speak before and I understand pretty well how Israel does occupation, I don't even think I really still have a full appreciation for the full security apparatus that exists. Could you say a little bit more about what you do know about what surveillance and what the full breadth of the security apparatus of Israel looks like, as far as you know?
All right. Well, again, I don't know much, but I can tell you because it's all top secret, right? But we have an organization called the General Security Service, sometimes compared to the American FBI. It's like a super police with a lot of special rights and access to the best technologies, and it's high-paying jobs, and it's attractive for very well-trained people, and they do their own trainings. And the General Security Service is a very powerful, very influential and powerful organization in Israel, which works largely in secret, without much legal supervision. Certainly over, and a lot of its work is controlling Palestinians who, again, are not Israeli citizens and don't enjoy Israeli civil rights. So the General Security Service is very big and is concerned largely, as far as I understand, with operating Palestinian informants and collaborators. So running agents, basically, but huge numbers of them in the Palestinian population who need permits, who need to stay out of Israeli prison, who need to avoid having their house demolished or other things, and become collaborators, informants for the General Security Service. Plus, there is a system which is an Israeli military system, which is basically a lot of the stuff that you've heard about from Edward Snowden that the NSA is doing. So systems that filter, go through all the emails, all the phone calls, except in the case of Palestinians under Israeli control, they don't have to say we're just using metadata or we're not, because again, these are people without civil rights, so they can use whatever information and follow people in every way they please, and they have a great technological scope to do that. Basically have whatever it is the NSA has. Some of it is co-developed. Yeah, so Palestinians are some of the most surveilled people, both electronically and then with this whole internal system of informants and collaborators. Plus, the official Palestinian police, which operates in some areas of the autonomy, not in East Jerusalem, is also, in fact, they call it a security cooperation, but is also, in fact, subject to Israeli military government. And so Israel has access to a lot of means of control of Palestinians. And they arrest people. They have administrative arrest, which is basically what you guys, I think, still have in Guantanamo, right? Holding people without trial. But great numbers of people, and also the people who are convicted, often the evidence against them, their lawyers are not even allowed to see it, because the General Security Service comes to the judge and says, here's security information we have, and we can't show it because that might reveal the source, and the judge will, and the people don't even know exactly what they stand accused of and what the evidence is against them.
Earlier, you rightly said, in my opinion, that countries who view the West Bank and East Jerusalem principally, and maybe Gaza as well, as illegally occupied, you were saying that what you don't see from them is any sort of follow-up about the actual conditions on the ground, which don't change just because Donald Trump said Jerusalem is the capital of Israel. Why don't they do something more concrete, do you think?
Well, I don't know who is they, but let's say who we heard from a lot is Europe, right? Is
sure, France. That's a good day. Let's use them.
So Europe, Israel is not a member of the European Union, but we have a very favorable trade agreement with the European Union, and it's our biggest trading partner. And Israel, we play sports in the European leagues because our neighbors won't play with us. And we're, in many ways, we're like a suburb of Europe. And Europe is in on many, so Israel is in on many EU projects, especially in research and science, but also in security. And Israel is a useful ally for the EU economically, and I think basically, fundamentally, the foreign policy of Europe, at least until now, has tended to be really whatever America says. So they make statements where they differ from American policy, but generally they go along with it. I think, well, I just think Europe does a lot of business with Israel. And it's easy to make statements, but taking actions, which might upset things, maybe is harder to do.
But with all this intermingling, right, that the sounds like the Israeli economy is contingent upon trade with Europe, it also means that these European allies have a measure of leverage that they could use if they wanted to force Israel to make certain changes, but they don't.
All right. So could is a good, I mean, certainly if Europe were to say, for example, the EU has an EU-Israel association agreement. That's a trade agreement, basically. Like all of Europe's trade agreements, it says, its clause two is, these relations shall be dependent on respect for human rights and democratic principles. And there's a pile of reports from European Union representatives about Israeli systematic violations of Palestinian human rights and democratic principles in ruling Palestinians. So in theory, it would be legally and easy for Europe to say, well, our continued trade agreements, favorable trade agreements, depend on, and then make some operable list of what that would mean, respect for human rights and democratic principles. They've never done that. And I don't know enough. I think part of the problem is that Europe is a very dysfunctional, I mean, the European Union is a very dysfunctional entity, which finds it hard to agree and organize around anything. And moving things through the European Parliament is maybe a little bit like moving things through the American government. It very rarely actually happens. So Europe is uncoordinated, is bureaucratically very heavy. And I think it finds it hard to actually take a stand that's against American foreign policy.
I've heard it suggested, and I think you've suggested it before as well, that the occupation and all that it entails for security is something that Israel successfully exports to places like Europe, like the United States, thus giving them something indispensable or important that they can't get from other countries.
All right. Well, I think that's an Israeli hope. So certainly Israel does a lot of that and is doing more and more. It's very fast growing. Israeli security services and training to American and European police forces, provision of various technologies and tactics, anti-terror, anti-riot, the stuff that is developed practicing on Palestinians then increasingly is getting exported. And of course, Israeli companies see a huge potential in a potential border wall between the US and Mexico, because who's going to get that contract? Maybe Israeli companies who have a lot of experience building elaborate fence systems. So Israel is a major exporter of security and what they're calling now pacification technologies. And there's more Israeli training and technology all the time being brought into American police forces and private security services, surveillance techniques and drone and camera and wall and fence. I think that's an Israeli hope that Israel would make itself so vital and so integrated into all those systems that it would make it much harder to sanction or pressure. I don't know if we've come to that point yet, but that's a direction we're going in.
Yeah. One thing I wonder about is, could the model that Israel uses in East Jerusalem, where they annexed that territory, gave those people residency status, right? Permanent residence. Can you imagine Israel adopting that same policy in the West Bank, annexing all of the West Bank, making those people permanent residents and treating it in the same way they have treated East Jerusalem?
Yeah, that's That's not so hard to imagine. There are Israeli politicians who have spoken about such ideas, but it won't change the basic fact that Palestinians will be under Israeli rule without Israeli citizenship, without independence, and they're going to keep demanding their independence, and they're going to keep resisting, and Israel is going to keep using force. So, yeah, but they might decide to change it from military government to civil government, but without citizenship, which arguably is sort of the definition of a legal apartheid.
Yeah.
So you have one state, but in it, populations with and without civil rights or with and without citizenship. They might do that. Yeah, it's imaginable.
Yeah. Well, any final things that we didn't cover that you think are important to understanding East Jerusalem, Trump's announcement?
I wish I understood anything about Trump.
Join the club.
I don't know if I'm hoping that he knows something. Mm-hmm. Like he has some great, clever plan, in fact, that this is part of. Because it seems just like almost random. Like there's some call from somebody saying we. I don't know if we said this, but my guess about American politics, which I don't understand, is that this statement appeals and appeases and goes to a certain evangelical base,
mm-hmm.
which for them, it's very, very important that not just that America supports Israel, but that America supports Israel in active conflict with its neighbors.
Mm.
And that's, as I understand it, part of ideas about terrible wars that have to come before or alongside the second coming of Jesus.
So, yeah, I'm sorry to say that you're on to something there.
Right.
We call it Christian Zionism, and yeah, Trump's did get a lot of support from people for whom that is important. He's also wildly unpredictable. So
right.
It's hard to say why. One thing is he promised it in the campaign and he wants to keep his promises. I suppose that's a positive.
Well, he didn't promise recognizing the capital. He promised moving the embassy.
True.
Moving the embassy, he has not done. He said he's going to form a committee to sign the waiver to postpone it. He said he's going to form a committee to... He's actually not... That would be a little bit more of a real move than this statement. Because there you actually have people moving, a building being built, or... Whereas this is just a statement, and it's not the promise that I heard him making, which was within 24 hours we're going to move the embassy.
True, true. You're right. Yeah, I don't think anybody knows exactly how to understand Donald Trump, and I have very little hope for it being a strategic move. I guess if it were strategic, I would have expected that he would have gain some sort of concession from Israel, for example, or would have also recognized something Palestinian so as to seem as though the U.S. actually still was pretending to be an honest arbitrator between the two.
I'm going to say something terrible.
Please.
What you're saying would make sense if his strategy was peace, right? Or quieting down the situation.
Right.
What if this was strategy, but the strategy was to push for an eruption of violence, for more military conflict in the Middle East, which... You know, he did go to Saudi Arabia and signed that deal to increase our shipments there. Maybe there is a strategy, but it's not a nice one.
True. I did wonder if Netanyahu gave the okay for such an announcement because he wanted some sort of distraction from either his own scandals or because the Palestinians were in the process of forming a unity government, and a unity government is not something that Israel wants.
Right. Yeah, I think both in the case of Trump and in the case of Netanyahu, you could say maybe they did it to distract from their last criminal investigation against people close to them and scandals closing in on them, because it's true in both their cases. I think the Palestinian Unity Government is such a seems like such a faltering effort at this point that it doesn't seem like a very serious threat to Israeli policymakers, but maybe criminal investigation that need distracting from. That's a likely explanation in both cases, Netanyahu and Trump.
Yeah. Well, those are at least interesting speculations to think about. And I'm going to end it there and just say thank you so much for giving us more insight into East Jerusalem and all the issues related to it.
Thanks. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Viscast. If you want to learn more about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, I invite you to go to my website, joshvis.com. And I want to point you to two things on that website. One is upcoming tours. We have a tour in May. All of our tours do two things together, which is take you to the biblical and historical and archaeological sites and give you quality teaching at those places, and also give you speakers and experiences so that you can learn more about the contemporary conflict. Another thing I would ask you to look at is the events. In January, we have two events on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. One is January 16 in Holland, Michigan, and the other is January 18 in Des Moines, Iowa. Both events are free. I will be speaking at both events, as will May Cannon, an expert on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. So check it out, joshvis.com.